speak English. Okay, and the Paschal mystery, Pascha.
There we go. I'm going to be, I feel like I ought to be talking on the ESPN sideline with this little gizmo. Are we all set? Yeah, it is working. I've worn it twice in mass, and each time this little piece falls off and gets yanked off my back, so I'm still learning how to work all this gobbledygook. So where was I? Oh, Paschal mystery. Okay, so that's the Passover. And somehow or other, the Greek and the English and the Hebrew all sound like the same. Someone who knows Hebrew and Greek can correct me on that, but basically it means the Passover, and we're going to get to what that's about. It's a season of 40 days of fasting, and the old Passover bridges to the new Passover. So the old Passover was the story of how the Israelites who were enslaved by the Egyptians got out of Egypt. That should be a familiar story to you. I don't really want to embarrass you by raising your hand if you don't know it, so I'll quickly cover it. They were enslaved by the Pharaoh, and he was concerned about the fact that they were strong and fertile. So they were having a lot of babies, so he put them to tougher and tougher tasks and made it harder and harder for them to do their work. And eventually Moses was called by God to lead the people out of slavery. And there were a series of events that eventually they did get out, and we're going to cover those. And the new Passover, yeah, here we go, here's the stuff. So, they were given a lot of rules, but this is kind of what went on. So in chapter 12, I should say, is the 10 plagues and of Exodus. The 10 plagues, water turned to blood, we had frogs and gnats and flies, all the livestock died. None of this happened to the Israelites, okay, this is only happening to the Egyptians. Boils, thunder and hail, locusts, darkness. And then the 10th plague was that the firstborn of all the Egyptians, including beasts, would be killed by the angel of death. But the Israelites were told, you're going to mark your houses with the blood of a lamb, and you're going to put that blood on the posts and the lintel with a hyssop branch. And when the angel of death sees the house marked that way, he will pass over that house and not bring the divine retribution. And then Moses was told, this is going to be the central feast for the people of God from now on. In fact, this month will now be the first month of your year. And on I think it's the 10th day of this month is when you'll do all this stuff. And you will have a ritual meal that you will do, and you will call it the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover. For Bible scholars, I put some of the verses from Exodus chapter 12 where this is talked about, okay? So this is the memorial that they are going to do to remember that God saved them from slavery, and it has a particular ritual about it. Jesus, on Holy Thursday, was following this ritual meal, which was called the Seder meal. And it had a particular sequence of what happened. They had to eat a lamb. It had to be a particular type of lamb. They had to sing hymns. The psalms from our book of the Psalms are the hymns that they sang. Psalm is just a word for a song. They had to sing particular songs at particular times. There were 5 cups of wine, 4 of which were drunk at particular points in the meal, and the 5th cup was Elijah's cup that was not drunk. A big part of it was that a younger person would stand up and ask some ritualized questions, tell basically grandpa or whoever the eldest male was, tell me the story of why we're doing this meal and why we're doing it the way we're doing it. And so you would have this Passover narrative where he would, again, scripted, he would say, explain the story of why they were doing it. The main meal was a roasted lamb with unleavened bread. They ate herbs, but they had bitter sauce put on them. And so the opening would be a blessing and a cup of wine. Then they would have this Passover narrative and a short song of praise and then they would have a second cup of wine. And this isn't like, you know, getting smashed. This is a ritualized cup of wine, okay? And then they would have the main meal with the unleavened bread and the bitter herbs and spices. And they would have the third cup of wine. Then they would have a big long song of praise, the Great Hallel, which was Psalms 114 through 118. That's a lot of singing. It takes a long time. And at that point, they would drink the fourth cup of wine, and the closing words were, "It is finished." In the Greek, I think that's tetelestai. Okay? And that was the end of the center meal. And the purpose of this meal was to memorialize their salvation from slavery in Egypt. So the Triduum is a phrase you'll hear. It means the 3 days. It's Holy Thursday, Good Friday, and Holy Saturday. And that is how we go from a Seder meal to Calvary, which is the cross, where the cross was. Okay? Calvary means skull, because Jesus was crucified at the place of the skull, which in Hebrew is Golgotha. Okay? So we go from the preparations for the Seder meal, that's in Luke and in Matthew. You guys may remember that three of the Gospels kind of tell the story in the same way, and many times you'll find almost identical words in the two of them. So Luke and Matthew are two of the three synoptic Gospels. So the preparations for the Seder, going and finding the room in the house and preparing the meal, the apostles were sent to do that. Then it follows the traditional sequence. You see in, this may or may not have been part of it, but in John, the Gospel of John, Jesus has a long, long discussion in the upper room. And they are singing the hymns, and they are drinking the cups of wine, as everyone would expect. But all of a sudden, there is a break. If you had your Bibles, you can read in Matthew 26, chapter 26, verses 29 and 30, and again in Mark, it's basically the same words. Jesus says, "I will not drink from the cup of the fruit of the vine until I have come to my glory." Okay, so at the point where we would have drunk that fourth cup, and then the elders, which in this case would have been the Rabbi Jesus, would have said, "It is finished." We just stop. The meal stops. People who have talked about this have said it would be the same as if after the priest said, "This is the cup of my salvation," everybody just left Mass. And it was a very profound kind of a break, and it didn't really make sense. So you can understand why the apostles seemed to be kind of confused for the rest of the whole Passion. But then if you take verses from the Gospels, you can see that what happened was Jesus was going to use his own Passion to complete a new Passover sacrifice. So he endures the going back and forth from the high priests, then he has to go to Herod, then he goes back to the high priest, then he goes to Pontius Pilate, he's scourged. He is then judged to be going to be crucified. He has to carry his cross to the place of the skull. And they offer him myrrh, which is going to be a make your mind, you won't be able to feel the pain as much as you die from suffocation, which is basically how you're dying when you die from crucifixion. He refuses that. But at the end, they hold up a branch of sour wine on a hyssop branch, and he takes that, and then he says, "It is finished." So what Christians understand is that the Triduum, the 3 days, is Christ instituting a new Passover sacrifice. So when you read things like that the Old Testament is completed, the Old Covenant is completed and fulfilled in the New Covenant, that's what we're talking about. You no longer have to follow all of the 613 laws that Moses gave in Deuteronomy. You just have to do what Jesus instituted. And that's why we do what we do. I think I've used this picture before, but there is us. This looks the same. I mean, it's different people, obviously. But it's the same when the bishop is here, or Father Magnemi, or Father Pays, or whoever it might be. It's the same sacrifice of the Mass. And we have a very ritualized meal, don't we? With prescribed readings, prescribed songs, prescribed phrases. That's why liturgists will tell you that you should really just say the words that are written in the book. Don't make it up. Do what he told us to do. And he tells us that in the words of institution, that this is my cup, and whenever you do this in remembrance of me. There you go, okay? The Israelites were told to do this in remembrance of me. Luke, I picked him, gives an example of the new Passover ritual. And then already by the time that St. Paul is writing to the Corinthians, so that's 25 years later, it's already a tradition. He says, I'm just passing on to you what was handed on to me, that on the night he was handed over to death, our Lord. That's what's being recounted in chapter 11 of 1 Corinthians. So it's already the thing that we do as Christians, this ritualized meal. And we use the word remembrance, we use the word memorial. The fancy word is anamnesis, because what we believe is, and I think Father Michael talked about this when he talked about the Mass, that we time travel as Catholic Christians, that in the liturgy, we recall, we take ourselves back to the sacrifice at Golgotha and the salvation of the cross. So that in a mysterious way, our Mass at 5:45 on a Sunday afternoon participates in the Mass that happened, in the sacrifice that happened at Calvary in AD 33, and it also participates in the eternal Mass going on in heaven, even now. So that's part of why it's a mystery, because you know, rationally, we can't really make sense of all of those things, right? Any questions about any of that? I kind of went through it kind of fast. Any challenges?
When he takes the wine when he's on the cross, that's the completion of.
And he says, it is finished. It is consummated. If you, we'll get to it, but when you go to the 3-hour service on Good Friday, typically, and certainly at this parish, there are short meditations on what are called the 7 last words of Christ on the cross, and one of those is, it is finished. So it always strikes me that if you're being suffocated and you're hanging by nails through here and here and then through your feet to keep you from jerking around, to get a breath, the amount of effort that was required to do that in order to say these things for us to hang on to, they're incredibly powerful. So, yeah, but he says those words. The new Passover sacrifice is finished. And that's why we do what we do. And that's why we don't mess with it. You know, they had the same Mass, no changes, for 400 years, from about 1570 till about 1970. And then we've kind of updated things. But it's important that we don't keep making up new Masses all the time, because there's the one Mass that memorializes what Christ needs to do.
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
So I've been discussion that people have? Is there
I don't think that the church has an official teaching on Pontius Pilate. He's a historical figure, certainly important to the story, but I don't know there's a deep theology developed about him. He certainly is a great tool for us to kind of meditate on, because he does seem to have certain signals, and in some of the Gospels he is presented in such a way that he seems to have a clue that he's participating in a very evil act. But he also seems not to have the strength to resist participation in the evil act. So I think in some ways he's a great model for us. We're going to find times when we're going to have the strength not to participate in an evil act. And we don't want to be remembered like Pontius Pilate. And he's also, to me, a great, very modern person. When he's standing face to face with truth incarnate, he says, "What is truth?" You know, all your cell phones absorbed nihilists are sitting there, you know, "What is truth?" You know, I make up my own truth, right? And of course, that's not the Christian mindset, but that is the modern mindset. That I make up my own truth, and you make up your own truth, and we only have an issue when the truths bump into each other. And then it becomes a power game, pretty much, right? If I've got the power, then you're going to bake my cake for me, and if I don't have the power, you won't, right? That kind of a thing. But we don't really have an agreed truth. Well, Christians do. It's Jesus Christ. But we're no longer the dominant philosophy in the world, which is, you know, kind of a cool thing. We're not guerrillas for Christ. You know? We're not getting the support of the state anymore. So if you stand up for Christ now, you are really standing. And that's, don't lose heart, but know what you're doing. Any other questions? So I'm going to move on to Lent. I think we're going to be done a lot faster than Helen thought. Okay. So that's all kind of the thought process behind it. And Lent is a time for us to prepare for this really big thing that's happening. It's going to be a really big thing for you guys because you're actually going to go and participate in the Great Easter Vigil. But a lot of Catholics really look forward to the season of Lent as a time for renewal, for stripping away. You know, if you've ever been in salt water on a boat and grime and barnacles begin to accumulate on the hull of the boat, you kind of have to lift it out of the water and scrape them off in order to get it clean again. And Lent is a great time for cleansing, throwing out the stuff that I've kind of accumulated that has separated me from God, and trying to get back to the bare bones Christian faith. Okay, so we talk about the 40 days of the Lenten fast. 40 is a biblical number that typically is associated with penitential things. The Israelites spent 40 years wandering in the desert because when they first went into the promised land, they thought they saw giants and they ran back. And so for their lack of faith, they spent 40 years preparing. Jesus spent 40 days in the desert being tempted by the devil. Okay, so 40 is a biblical number meaning a long time, and also typically related to preparation for something big. Okay? So how do we get to 40? Because if you add up 6, 7 weeks, you get to more than 40. You get to 46. Well, the purple days are the days of fasting. You don't fast on Sunday, which is a feast day, okay? So if you take those days and get rid of the Sundays, you end up with 40 days, okay? From Ash Wednesday to Holy Saturday. So Lent doesn't end on Holy Thursday. Lent ends on Holy Saturday. Okay. So what is fasting? In the old days, fasting was not eating anything all day except maybe a light snack. Okay. We've gotten softer as we've gotten more modern. So now it is only one meal and a light snack. Okay. But it's always a form of prayer. So if you're a person who routinely doesn't have breakfast, then maybe for you, fasting is not eating until supper. If you're a person who is hypoglycemic and you can't go more than 90 minutes without something, okay, then maybe for you, fasting is trying to go 2 hours. Okay, it has to be a prayer device. If you're spending all your time thinking about the fact that I haven't eaten and I can't wait till I get those peanuts, you're not really praying, are you? Right? You're thinking about peanuts. So you have to use your own judgment on it. All right? Now, it's between you and God, and He knows what you really can do. So, you know, you have to work that out. But it's equally bad to get so locked into rules that we, you know, I read it this way, it says I gotta fast, I'm gonna fast, and even if I die, at least I passed it. That's not correct, okay? So you're gonna have to pray about this. Surprise, surprise, surprise. The Christian life involves prayer. Okay, so this is a prayer device. During the season of Lent, we have 2 days of fasting, Ash Wednesday and Good Friday, okay? So I frequently don't eat breakfast. So for me, I'm just not supposed to eat on Ash Wednesday, and I'm not supposed to eat on Good Friday. Okay? Another person, Helen, can't do that, but she's got to eat a little bit. All right?
Can you do what?
Go all day without eating.
Oh, yeah.
But on Fridays in Lent, we abstain. We don't eat meat. Okay? Again, way back in the day, Catholics were known as fish eaters because we didn't eat meat on any Friday of the year. In the United States, coming out of Vatican II, the American bishop said, you don't have to be rigidly locked into not eating meat on Fridays. And most American Catholics did not hear the second part of that, which was, you still need to do something of a penitential nature on Fridays. Okay? So we're all eating a lot of hamburgers on Fridays, and I hope we're doing something of a penitential nature on Fridays. You should be doing that as a Catholic. But during the season of Lent, we go back to the old way, and you don't eat meat on Fridays. Okay? Yes?
And Fridays are a symbol of the crucifixion?
Fridays is historically, yes, reminding us of Good Friday. Exactly. That's a great point. That's why we take Friday for that. I think the Orthodox, they're like the super varsity Christians, so they don't eat eggs, they don't eat, there's a whole bunch of things they don't eat. They don't do it on Wednesdays or Fridays. But that's not us. We take it a little bit easier. Okay, so who must fast? If you're between 18 and 60, if you're not sick or pregnant, or it would be dangerous to you. Okay? Make sense? And likewise, who must abstain from meat on Fridays? Well, we think the kids can do it, so it's 14 to 60. If you are not sick, pregnant, or it would be dangerous. Okay? If it would be dangerous, is an opportunity for you to define danger yourself. Again, that's, you know, God knows, so be honest with Him. My own personal sin life is that I'm the last person to believe the lies that I tell, so I always need to remember that when I look at the scales of justice, it turns out I've always got my thumb on one of the two sides. So I'm never really objective with my own stuff. I need somebody outside to say, "Bran, that's not really true." Okay, so that is the rules for Lent. Any questions about that? So a lot of people give something up or take something on during Lent as a spiritual discipline. Okay, if you give something up, make sure it's something that you could do on Sundays. So if you give up cursing, you're not supposed to be cursing, okay? But if you give up ice cream sandwiches because you really like ice cream sandwiches, it's inappropriate at all for you to have an ice cream sandwich on Sunday, okay? And that'll help you pick the thing. This is not a self-improvement thing. This is not a forced diet. You know, I'm going to go to Lent. It's going to be really great. I'm going to lose 10 pounds. This is a prayer tool, okay? So I wouldn't encourage you to have it be a workout program, okay? I mean, do that. That's awesome, but don't have that be your Lent discipline, okay? All right, so let's move on to Holy Week. There we go, okay. A lot of stuff happens in Holy Week. And I'll just use here as an example. So the Mass on Palm Sunday, Passion Sunday, there's two gospel readings. There's a reading that recounts Jesus' triumphant entry into Jerusalem on a donkey with the palms. That's why we have the palms. If you come here to the 9 o'clock Mass, you'll actually see a donkey, and we'll take the donkey all the way around the church property. He does not come into the church, but then we do. Okay? And then, at the time of the Gospel, we read the Passion narrative, typically having people sing the different voices. Okay, and frequently with the kids, they sort of play active. Okay, so that starts Holy Week. Then on Holy Thursday, there are a couple of things. It's also called Maundy Thursday in a lot of English communities because the Latin word for "I do this," the mandate, is mandatum. Okay, so this is where Jesus in the upper room instituted the Mass. It's also where he instituted the priesthood. The scene of Jesus washing the feet of the 12 disciples is understood by the church as a model for how a bishop should lead but serve his priests. Okay, he's not a tyrant over them. He is their brother and father, and he serves them the same way Jesus did, because Jesus says, you should do what I do here. Okay. Here in this diocese, I think we don't just do 12 men. It's typically kids now from different parts of our parish community that go that have their feet washed. But if you come to the Holy Thursday Mass, which I think Helen's going to tell you should come to, it'll be long because that will go on in it. And at the end of Holy Thursday Mass, we will process with the reserved sacrament over to what's called an altar of repose. If you're looking at the main altar over here, the Joseph side, we sort of put flowers over there, and that's going to be the Garden of Gethsemane, sort of, if you will. Okay? And we take the reserved sacrament over there, and we have a vigil all night long there. And then you'll notice that the Mass doesn't have its traditional ending. There is no ending. And the servers will start to take all, everything that moves, they'll try to take off of the sanctuary, the place where the altar is. You'll see them carrying chairs and things like that out of there to have it be totally stripped bare. And then we'll come back on Good Friday for a few different liturgies. One I mentioned before is the 3 hours. Traditionally, Christians wanted to be being with Jesus while he was on the cross for the 3 hours. How am I going to fill up the 3 hours? Somebody said, why don't we have meditations on the 7 last words? And I'm going to give you those words. So at the beginning, Jesus says from the Gospel of Luke, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Then he has a dialogue with the two thieves. If you remember, one of the thieves mocked him, but the other one said, Jesus, remember me when you come to paradise. And Jesus said, this day you will see me in paradise. Okay. Then the third word we have actually depicted on that relief above the high altar, where Jesus looks down to Mary and John and says, woman, behold your son. Son, behold your mother. Then the fourth word, Jesus is reciting Psalm 22, which starts out, my God, why have you forsaken me? A great Lenten discipline would be to read that psalm over and over and over again. And you will notice that it starts with this tone of despair. And then it, towards the last third of the psalm, all of a sudden he kind of realizes that God is going to save him. And it turns into a very joyful psalm. So you hear, my God, why have you forsaken me? You're like, yeah, see, he's given up. No, he knows that God's going to take care of him. Then the fifth word, recounted in the Gospel of John, he says, I thirst. That's when they raise the wine-soaked hyssop branch to him. And then he says, it is finished. And then the last word is, into your hands I commend my spirit, from the Gospel of Luke. So we have that series of meditations on those words, and it's mostly us just being kind of quiet with Jesus. And if you can't stay for the whole period, that's fine, because it is from noon to sort of, it doesn't really, for us it doesn't seem to take up the whole 3 hours, but it's the church is in quiet for a while, okay? That's a great time for you to One of the things I always ponder is why we call that day Good Friday. And that's a great kind of spiritual reflection for you to have. How can something that's so awful be Good Friday? Then we will have something that's called Veneration of the Cross. So they'll bring in a cross, and it used to be that everybody would go and sort of double genuflect three times on their way, and each person in the community would kiss the cross. Because of the numbers, we now have the priests and the deacons and the servers kiss the cross, and then we leave the cross so that the faithful can come and venerate the cross too, to kiss the wood of the cross. Again, part of the trying to figure out why that's Good Friday, given how what terrible things seem to happen. Then there's no Mass on Good Friday, so we have Holy Communion from the reserved sacrament. So the bishop blessed enough hosts so that we put those in the altar of repose, and on Good Friday we go get those, and we all go and consume that. Okay? And if we do it right, there will be no host left. Okay? So there's on Holy Saturday, there is no reserved sacrament. And then we'll come back in the evening for Stations of the Cross. Which if you've never experienced that, I encourage you to go. We have it every Friday and during Lent, to go and just participate. That you're just walking the way of sorrows, the way of the cross, tracking Jesus as he goes to his crucifixion.
7 p.m. in the cathedral, every Friday.
And after 6:45 Mass, so if you're an early morning person, Deacon Chris Andronico leads it Friday mornings. Now there's another liturgy which traditionally is associated with Holy Thursday, but because we don't want to kill our bishop, we've moved it to Tuesday of Holy Week, and that's the Chrism Mass. There are three oils that the bishop and the priest use, the oil of catechumens, the oil of chrism, and the oil of the sick. And this is olive oil. And chrism has had this balsam added to it to give it that distinctive smell. And so the priests from the diocese come, and the bishop is preaching to his priests. They are renewing their priestly commitments to him. And he blesses the oils, which are then distributed to the parishes. So they come, and it's a really powerful thing. You kind of get to look over the shoulder of the bishop preaching to his brothers. And then they all circle around the altar for the consecration. It's a really cool thing. Yes, ma'am?
And we're rehearsing right after that. So if you want, you can come to that and then just stay for
the rehearsal. There you go. Perfect. So I think it's at 5, so your rehearsal's probably at 6:30?
No, well, technically 7.
7, okay. Yeah. It's a long thing, and I hope I'm doing something else, because the tough job is to be one of the 6 deacons who has to lug these things of olive oil from the back of the church to the front and then back again. But it's a very powerful liturgy. It only happens once a year. It's kind of cool for us to kind of look over the shoulder and watch it. Now, you can't come into the church before the Mass because the priests are hearing each other's confessions. So, you know, we have these days of penance where you can go and all the priests are hearing our confessions. And then that day, they're hearing each other's confessions. Very, very powerful thing. Okay, then we get to Holy Saturday, and the only liturgy is morning prayer. Because the Easter Vigil Mass is actually for Easter Sunday. It just starts in the evening. And is it okay to tell them what happens there?
No.
No, okay. Really cool stuff happens there. Okay.
It's beautiful, and it's the best experience that you have ever been before. It will blow your mind, and so it's better if you don't touch it. Suffice to say, it's the most beautiful.
It's also ancient. Okay, a lot of the beauty of the Catholic faith is that it's ancient. They've been doing this stuff for 1,000 years.
2,000 years.
Well, the first thing they did just came from Charlemagne, so that's about 800.
Okay.
So, 1,200 years, okay? But it's really, really cool. And you'll get a lot out of it, so I guess I won't. I think I'm done, sweetie. So I can take questions?
At 7:30.
Yes, ma'am.
The veneration of the cross, can we participate in the kissing of the cross?
Absolutely. So what happens is, at the end of it, oh, you mean as catechumens and canons? Absolutely, absolutely.
And then, can you touch on Ash Wednesday a little bit?
Yes, thank you. I think I was supposed to do that. I had the pages down the wrong order, so I'm messing up. Okay, there you go. You know, if a husband is alone in the forest, is he still wrong? So Ash Wednesday. So that is, what you'll hear him say is, remember that you are dust and to dust you shall return. Okay? That is a reminder to us that we are created beings. It's a beautiful, non-required ceremony. It's not a holy day of obligation. I think it is, there's a Catholic Onion type site, and they had a wonderful fake news story about the Baptist saying it's their favorite sacrament. But a lot of non-Catholics come to our church to have ashes imposed. It's a great physical reminder of my place in God's creation. I am his beloved child, but I am his child, not him. And sometimes, under my own power, I begin to think I'm God, and it's a wonderful once-a-year reminder that I'm not. What do you do after, like Father Morrow, I don't know what he puts on his thumb, but that stuff gets on your fart and it ain't coming off. Okay? So pick your priest. And I have gone both ways, you know, because I typically go early in the morning. I work with a bunch of Presbyterians, and it doesn't seem to bother them now. So the first time you do it at work, you're like, hey, you got a smudge in your head. Okay. The second time is, oh, it's Ash Wednesday. It's a very, you know, if you're not filled with pride because you got a smudge in your head, then you may be a great witness of the good news of Jesus Christ because you got a smudge in your head. You walk around going like this, maybe you're making it more about you, okay? And again, that's kind of, you've got to pray about that. It may be that out of charity with your coworkers, the best thing for you to do is go wipe it off. That you're going to have to know what your Wednesday is like. Yes, sir.
So every Ash Wednesday, the reading is something to the effect of, you know, when you pray, you go to your room.
Exactly. That's right. Don't make a big deal about it.
What's the logic behind that reading with this, hey, I've been to Mass today, on your forehead? They seem to be mixed messages.
I think they are, right? Now, why would the church give you two different messages?
I don't have an answer, but I have been ordained.
So you could think about it. I don't have an answer either. I think it's to put the question out there, okay? You are marked by the sign of the cross. How public are you willing to be about that? And again, if you just have it on your head, okay? And particularly if you move around at all, and now, you know, you don't have any hair that falls down, it's never going to get smudged, but... you know, it might just look like a dirt mark. I mean, sometimes it's just, it's all it looks like. It's like he went like this and then went like that, and it just looks like a smudge. So, yes, Chris?
I think that, you know, being the, as private, it's a public act, but it's private for you, as a reminder for you, not necessarily a reminder for the wider world after you leave the church. So, the gospel reading, of go in your room, made a public act, but it's a good reminder for you personally. And I think beyond that, it doesn't have to be a public act.
That's right. It's really how you're going to feel. Okay?
You don't need to feel bad if you decide to wipe the ashes off.
Yeah, it's totally fine.
If you
totally
decide
fine.
To wipe them off, that's okay.
Totally fine.
If you
yes.
decide to leave them on, that's okay.
Well, I'd just like to say that when this tradition started, it started in Catholic communities. So it would not have been remarkable, you know, up in New Orleans or Boston.
Yeah, everybody had it. Right.
You had Wednesday off.
Right, that's right.
Because you were Catholic and they didn't know the business.
Right,
that's right.
So you were
Yes, ma'am.
I'm going to be out of town, and I understand I can go
anywhere.
Anywhere. And so do you just look up a schedule? Is this a certain time, and do you just look up a schedule?
Yep. And in most Catholic parishes, they will have, like, we're going to have, it's like Easter. We're going to have two-a-days. I mean, every Mass is going to be two, pretty much.
And then you just stand in line and go up?
They typically do it sort of after the readings. So for the sponsors, you're going to go up twice. You're going to go up and get your ashes. You're going to come back. You're going to go up for communion.
There's a website called masstimes.org.
Yeah, that's a great place.
A lot of
masstimes.org.
Did you say where the ashes came from?
Oh, yeah. So where do the ashes come from? The palms from last Palm Sunday. They collected them and they burned them. So that's where the ashes are coming from.
Okay, but we don't really do that
there. This is a rich Buckhead parish. I'm sure we bought soot that was burned by some poor parish. Add a little charcoal for color. Right.
Well, here's a warning. This is like, you really have to come early to find a parking space.
It's a very, very full day. So,
it's the busiest day ever.
Yeah, it's very, very full. Because, you know, an awful lot of the Presbyterians don't really have this. So if this is spoken to a Presbyterian's heart, he's got to go find a Catholic church.
Stay till the end of Mass.
Yeah. You guys know who left early, don't you? Judas. So, just say it. I don't know. Not a holy day.
It's not a solemnity, and it's not...
It's just a sacramental. Right, it's just a sacramental. I don't think so. I don't think Good Friday is a holy day of obligation.
There's no Mass on Good Friday. Pentecost was.
Yeah. Any other questions? Comments?
That
one?
That one? Yeah. Yeah, I can send the
slideshow.
Yeah. I'm assuming we can drink water and
absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So, you know, I heard from a priest that on a fast, you know, you're supposed to stay away from nutritive stuff, right? But if you're so addicted to coffee, it's now medicinal, and you can have your coffee.
Okay, seriously, that same priest clarified something for me, because we have a sponsor who he and I used to sit here and argue about this, because I'm very addicted to coffee. And I always said, I have to have some milk in my coffee, because I can't drink black, it's gross to me black. So if I'm going to drink coffee on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday, because I'm not eating as much food, I'm going to put some milk in it because I can't drink it black. This is a first world problem. And so that was just the deal. And the sponsor always said, but that's nutritive. There is nutrition in the milk, and so then you're breaking the spirit of it. So this priest came to Foundations of Faith, talked about reverence in January, and I specifically went up to him after the presentation. I said, okay, I just need a clarification on this, because I was sure I was right. He was like, yeah, you're not supposed to have milk in your coffee. So the sponsor, and I've already told him, he's floating over there. I told him that he, in fact, was correct. So here's and it is because you're not supposed to eat. You could, if I go to Starbucks and get four lattes in the day, I'm going to not really probably be abstaining a whole lot. It's a lot of calories. So. I mean, again, this is the spirit of the thing. So just take it. You also don't want to...
You were educated by the Jesuits, weren't you?
Yes. If you get so caught up in the rules that you're thinking more about the rules than the prayerful part of this and what you're offering up for Jesus, we've missed the point. So don't get so hung up on the rules that that's all you're focusing on. The point is to offer something up and to abstain so that you are giving up something to improve your prayer life and offer something up to God. So I'm just telling you, I did clarify that, because last year I stood up here and was like, milk is fine in coffee, but it's actually not. So I'm going to drink Diet Coke. But there's the answer, you know, just to drink Diet Coke all day. I quickly thought that. I was like, how am I going to be happy? Okay, Diet Coke. I really can't drink coffee black. It makes me feel sick. So then my brain's going to be covered in aspartame.
Yes, ma'am.
I understand. I know how to fast, and I know how to pray, but something I've always struggled with through Lent is understanding how they go together at all. Why we fast in general, what we have to do with prayer, and what they have to do with...
That's a great question. What does fasting have to do with prayer? Well, part of it is that's our model. Okay, Jesus went and fasted for 40 days in the desert and was tempted by the devil. And the devil tempted him first with food, right? And then with other things. Part of it is a rumble in your stomach can sharpen your mind. You know, if all the blood has gone to my tummy because I've eaten a big meal, I may not be able to think about things as much. So I think it's mostly a discipline of saying, if you cut down on the food, the minimal suffering that you're enduring may help you have a sense of the great suffering that Jesus endured for you. Okay, so I think it is more to do with enhancing your awareness in your prayer life. Chris?
It's also about enhancing your hungry and you need something, you want, it enhances your ability to understand that I need things and I need God.